The Cluniac monastic movement. The 11th century was a century permeated by the influence of monasteries and monastic reformers. Pope Gregory I, in the 6th century, known as Gregory the Great, had worked in intimate concert with a monastic order, the Benedictines, to achieve world-changing events. A later Gregory, Pope Gregory VII, who named himself after the earlier, would follow this pattern and catapult the See of Rome to unheard-of heights of authority in the Church. The Cluniac monastics played a key role in this rise, for more than any other monastic order, past or present, they incarnated the principle of the absolute independence of the spiritual power from the temporal power. In the world of feudalism, no greater radicalism could have been imagined, and it would upend the Societas Christiana and introduce a new constitution for the Church. A constitution centered on the Pope of Rome in a way that had only been dreamed of and vaguely hinted at by previous powerful popes such as Leo I. Indeed, when Cluny itself, the original house of what would eventually become the Cluniac movement, was founded in 909 AD by Duke William the Pious of Aquitaine, its charter explicitly stipulated that, although it shall have the protection of those same apostles Peter and Paul and the defense of the Roman pontiff, those monks there congregated shall be subject neither to our yoke, nor to that of our relatives, nor to the sway of the royal might, nor to that of any earthly power. No count, no bishop whatever, not the pontiff of the aforesaid Roman see, shall invade the property of these servants of God, or alienate it, or diminish it, or exchange it, or give it as a benefice to any one, or constitute any prelate over them against their will. A number of Roman bishops confirmed these exemptions of Cluny from temporal interference, the most striking of which are John the 11th's phrases, free from all dominion, and they have unimpeded opportunity without the need of consulting any leaders. A key component of the Cluniac worldview was, accordingly, the possession of temporal and spiritual liberty. But as with everything in a world dominated by the memory of the universal empire of the Romans, even liberty was understood in a distinctly Roman fashion. In this case, the liberty aspired to by men of all social classes, but particularly monks, was thought of as a libertas romana, that is, a Roman liberty. This theme would be especially stressed by Gregory VII in many of his letters regarding monastic matters, and it would serve to place in bold relief the lofty visions of papal principality held by that most powerful pope. But Cluniac morality also came to dominate the ecclesiastical vision of the 11th century. The Cluniac vision of virtue, like other monastic visions, was as perfectionistic in its purity as the vice it perceived in the outside world was ubiquitous. Following the traditional scheme of the seven deadly sins inherited from the patristic reworkings of the pagan moralist philosophers like Cicero and Horace, the Cluniacs posited a sharp dichotomy between the ideal and the actual, and they sought ascent to the ideal and escape from the actual. In a church which, as one has put it, provided perilously few resources for the sinner to meet his needs as he experienced them in face of the overmastering prospect of the Last Judgment, the Cluniac monastery itself was dubbed the Refuge of Penance and contrasted to the vast and treacherous ocean of spiritual shipwreck outside. Everyone who could was urged to join himself to a Cluniac house, or, failing that, to provide materially for a new house, or, failing even that, to become what was called confraternal with a monastery. This sensitivity to the deep spiritual needs of everyone from the noble to the common man, combined with Cluny's instrumental role in curbing the appalling feudal violence through things such as the Peace of God and the Truce of God, made Cluny immensely popular through the Western Church on all levels of society. Significantly then, as Cluniac monasteries spread all across Europe with lightning speed, they took with them all the conceptual apparatus necessary for men to accept the revolution that was soon to emanate from the Roman See. Although there was no small amount of resistance to the growing primacy claims of that See, the pattern of the Cluniac monastic movement would eventually become, under Pope Gregory VII, the pattern for the entire Western Church. Just as all Cluniac monasteries were subject to the single jurisdiction of the Abbot of Cluny, so too would Gregory VII make the entire Western Church subject to the single jurisdiction of the Bishop of Rome. This is not hard to understand, for as one scholar has aptly noted of Cluny's progress in the decades after Gregory VII, by the 12th century, the originally modest establishment founded by William III had become a powerful network of houses that had expanded throughout the Latin world, extending as far as Christendom's limits, so that it confronted Islam in both the Iberian Peninsula and the Holy Land. This awesome destiny was what led the Cluniacs to confuse their own church with the universal church. And in that quote, all you have to do is replace Cluniacs with Roman, and you get leading the Romans to confuse their own church with the universal church. In sum, what made the Cluniac movement so different from other monastic orders was precisely that, as Roland Baton puts it, it envisioned a Christian reordering of the whole social fabric, monastic, civil, and ecclesiastical. The role of the monastery in the world was no longer directed to conversions, often nominal, but to the permeation of society by Christian ideals. Whereas Saint Benedict had sought to segregate his monks from society, the Cluniacs tried to integrate monasticism and society. This program to monasticize the whole world would become the great passion of the Gregorian reformers, who would effect what must be described not merely a reform of the church, but a revolution of it, a change centering upon the Roman See that would reverberate through the centuries. The major issue upon which the revolution would stake its claims was that of lay investiture, or the involvement of laymen in the affairs of the church. Interestingly, the battle against simony, which was wrapped up with lay investiture and had to do with attempts to buy church office, began in no small part by the Cluniac movement and would continue to be a major force in the church for the subsequent 4.5 centuries. The reforming zeal of the Cluniacs would eventually crystallize its major political emphases into a rigidly papal monarchist form of doctrine that would itself be in the crosshairs of the next great reformation in the 16th century. In the wake of the 11th century reforms, it seems anticlimactic to realize that the Cluniacs experienced a period of decline in the 12th century owing to poor government. However, they were soon revitalized under Peter the Venerable, who died in 1156. Still, their power, even during the period of decline, may be seen in the fact that it was largely due to the influence of Cluniacs and his family that Stephen, grandson of William the Conqueror, was able to secure the English throne for the period of 19 years, 1135 to 1154, that we know as Stephen's Anarchy. Cluniac support for Stephen rested significantly on a promise they extracted from him to recover and maintain the liberties of the church against the secular power. Nevertheless, Cluniac monasteries were again eclipsed after Peter the Venerable, this time by the newer monastic reformers issuing from the Cistercian houses. Various other factors, largely relating to the rise of nationalistic concerns over the next 7 or 8 centuries, at last resulted in the loss of most of the Cluniac order's vitality.